Hi, this is Chris Coyle, and I'm here with Dick Orkin. And
that's me, right?
That's you, right?
Okay, good.
So, Dick,
I'm sure I was here.
It's still you after all these years.
Yeah.
So, Dick, quit balking around and tell me the origin of Chicken Man.
Okay, for the 3,485th time, Chicken Man was actually born in the late 60s, I think it's precisely 1967, when there appeared on television a sort of campy spoof of the Batman comic strip. If those who are old enough to remember this, Batman was played by Adam West. Wonder what happened to him. Have you seen him lately?
No, I haven't.
And Robin was played by Burt Ward.
I haven't seen him either.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's something about playing Batman on television that apparently causes you to disappear very quickly. I don't know what happened to them. Anyway, there it was, a big hit on television, and I was the public affairs production director at WCFL Radio in Chicago, a station that Ken Draper had brought me to after I worked in Cleveland with Ken at what was then called KYW Radio. I didn't do much of the public affairs work, although I did in Cleveland for Westinghouse. I was mostly production director, which meant that I would do contest spots and I would do promotional spots for the DJs. And then occasionally I would do a little comedy series of some kind. And Ken thought, in view of the success of the campy Batman series on television, that we needed to do something. He was brilliant that way. Whatever was happening in the news, on television, in all American culture, he usually tried to pick up on. So he said, why don't you do a superhero for each of the DJs? And there were four or five on the station. And I did a hero for each of the DJs in another CD here with Mike King. I mentioned some of those. But the one that I chose for the Jim Runyon morning show was Chicken Man. And it wasn't a long decision, because I think I had Chicken Man in the back of my mind as a serial for some time before I was even asked the question of doing it. And that, I think, came from two things. One, when I was a kid, there were a lot of chickens in my life. My grandfather raised chickens in his home.
And in his home?
Yeah, in his home.
Okay.
And I was responsible. Well, actually, not in his home. Okay. Out in the backyard.
Okay,
in the chicken coop.
I was going to get scared there.
Occasionally, they did come into the house, but only to be weighed and then put it into a basket, a wicker basket, that I was to take to the butcher shop and have slaughtered for...
Oh, what a happy job you had.
Yeah. Imagine asking a 9-year-old kid to do that.
Oh, yeah. Different times.
Where am I taking this chicken, Grandpa? And to the butcher shop where you're going to have it killed.
Its head cut off.
Yeah. So I would do that. One time I actually watched it happen, and boy, was I sorry I saw that.
Oh, brother.
And I brought it back. And I was chickens were just everywhere in my life, and I was both frightened and fascinated by them. I did feed them in the chicken coop. And that part I liked, but
well, also the idea of being a chicken is so much the opposite
yes.
of being a superhero.
And that was why it came about, because I kept saying, "What's antithetical to a superhero? You know, a strong guy, a powerful
yes.
guy." And I thought a guy who has a chicken costume goes around fighting crime. And the other influence, a very big one that I don't think I talked about very much anywhere, was there was a television show. And I doubt, Chris, if you'll remember this, called Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford. Adam, our engineer, do you remember that?
Adam no? Adam is like 28, so
yeah.
I guarantee you that Adam probably barely remembers
Batman.
Well,
I was maybe 9 or 10 at the time, but Broderick Crawford played him as an arrogant know-it-all. And I always laughed at the series because no matter what opinion someone had about what was going on with the crime scene, he always knew better.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this kind of arrogant, no, that's not the way it works. I'll tell you what's going on here. And he was constantly, you know, correcting people. And he had this pompous, terribly pompous attitude about his work as a sheriff. I think he was, or a highway patrolman, that's what he was. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if all of the moments where he says, no, that's not the way it works, here's how it works, if in fact every decision he made was an error. I thought that would really be a funny show. And actually, if you remember, others picked up on that kind of idea as well.
Right.
The crime fighter, the Pink Panther series mm-hmm. with Peter Sellers was basically that, a superhero. He was a super cop who just were wrong about everything.
Right.
So when I combined all those things, the chickens and Broderick Crawford, oh, poor Broderick, who's no longer with us, but he was a good actor. And most people won't remember this either. He played one great movie role he played was Huey Long, in the story of Huey uh-huh. Long in Louisiana. But those things came together.
And there are a lot of chickens in Louisiana.
Yes,
so there is a very symbiotic kind of relationship there.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got to watch me. I'm going to wander here.
Well, what I was going to say, would it be fair to say then that Broderick Crawford or that kind of type was a model for at least Chicken Man?
Yes, but on reflection, many, 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 many years later, I think I was in therapy. Boy, this is really going to be self-disclosure. It occurred to me that there was a lot of Chicken Man in me, or in me there was Chicken Man. Because in my early days, when I didn't have a lot of confidence in anything I was doing, I tried to act like I did know what I was doing. I was very, I don't think arrogant, but I was very pompous about it. I was, no, I'll tell you how about we'll do here to make this work. And that was always going on with me. So I think I didn't know, I was unconscious on my part that I was modeling it
yes.
after my own behavior. I mean, I was a kid from a small town who had moved into larger communities. And
it was a way to mask your insecurity or to cope with your insecurity.
Exactly. So that was there too. And Chicken Man, of all of the superheroes that I had created at Ken Draper's suggestion, seemed to catch on more than any other. Mm-hmm. And along came a company out of Dallas, Texas, who were at an NAB, National Association of Broadcasters convention. They heard an episode of Chicken Man on WCFL, and they came to us and asked if they could syndicate it. And that was really how it got into massive distribution throughout the United States and later into Europe and American Forces Radio as well.
Were there any other conscious real-life models for the other characters?
I think so. The role of the police commissioner, the man who spoke like this constantly, yes, winged warrior, I have an important task for you, or to Miss Helfinger, he might say, put out the chicken the light because I believe that was in, what we were doing was imitating the Batman, the spotlight.
Yes.
Put out the chicken light because, and flash it in the sky, but of course it was broken, so they just had to take a chicken and release it, and it flapped around the city, and that signaled
yes.
Chicken Man that he was needed. But that character was, I think I can say this safely now after all these years, was based in part on the man who was the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, at least the voice was. And there was also something of the character in the Batman's television serial. Remember, the commissioner there had a voice that was up here like this and had a slight New York or maybe it was even a British accent, but he was very, very pompous, very knowledgeable. But he wasn't at all because he loved his coloring books and he just colored and was constantly asking Miss Helfinger, if the sky is blue, what color should I make the grass?
Right.
Green? Oh, all right, I'll do that then. I had it blue. And I don't think that was really Mr. Lee's character. Bill Lee was the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. But it certainly was his voice. And I saw him as a small man, short, that is, in stature. And Bill Lee was that. He was a wonderful, charming man, except on those occasions when he wasn't. But and there weren't many of those. And I tell a story about that, or Mike King and I tell a story about that in the other CD. But and he never remembered my name, which I think was really the inspiration for my choosing that character.
Mm-hmm.
He would come down the hall, and if he had an important dignitary from the union in town, he would see me at the water cooler, and he knew that he couldn't pass me without introducing me. But he never remembered my name, so he would say, oh, yes, and this young man here, this is a young man who does some very fine work for us, yes. And come a little further here, Mr. Whoever it was. And they would. And so I don't think he ever really, even when I left the station, knew who I was. So when I left, he didn't even know I was gone. There were others who, of course, did. And Tom Havlin, who was the general manager of the station. And several others, of course, did. And Ken Draper obviously did. But he – and then Miss Helfinger, I can't tell you that Miss Helfinger was modeled after anyone in particular, except that I knew from a dramatic standpoint, from a writing and dramatic and an acting standpoint, that we needed a center of sanity, that someone had to play straight to these.
Well, because you have two basically bumbling experts.
Yes.
On one hand, you have Chicken Man being the superhero who's not a superhero, and then you have the commissioner who, as you pointed out, is too busy coloring to do actually police work.
Yes.
And right smack in the middle, we have Miss Helfinger.
Yeah, who's the voice of, you know, who just barely tolerates.
I was just going to say that it's kind of like seething.
Yeah. And her voice is just seething
dripping
with sarcasm. And I thought about this during the time that I was creating the character, and I think I did have one model. I don't think it was a hard alignment with that model, but there was a teacher I had, an English teacher, who had that kind of no-nonsense approach. Even when she spoke to you as a student, she was dripping with sarcasm constantly because she didn't believe any student knew anything about anything. So maybe she was slightly, I'm not going to mention her name. But I only knew that I had to have, as you said, a straight, you know, voice or a straight character to play against the two bumbling idiots in the thing.
Right. So what was the daily routine for you writing and the producing over, what was it, how many episodes?
273, right? 273. And the last 65 I was so weary of writing these. Every single day I had to write.
So you were the one who wrote the first 263.
Yes. I would get up. I didn't write them at night. Occasionally I would write, if I got behind, I would write an episode in the evening hours at home while sitting and rocking my babies in their little carriages with my foot. I would have a legal pad on my knee and I would write an episode of Chicken Man or write a commercial or something. But it was during that period of early morning at WCFL radio, I take the train down from Mount Prospect, the Northwestern. I'd go immediately. And sometimes the ideas would develop while I was on the train. And I wouldn't write the spot, but the ideas would come to me on the train. Okay, what I'll do now is have him confront someone who kidnaps him. And it might be there was a character in I sometimes confuse Chicken Man with the Tooth Fairy. But there were various characters that were a part of the series, but not – they were sort of benign characters. They weren't really evil. And the most vicious crime that might have occurred in Chicken Man was someone either tearing a tag off a mattress or failing to put a coin in the parking meter. There really wasn't anything – and then when we did the series for the EPA I would talk about littering and conserving energy and all that kind of thing. But I would get there early in the morning. I remembered your question. You didn't think I did. I'd get there early in the morning, and I'd start writing. I just began, and I don't think that I spent a lot of time worrying about lines because they just sort of – I knew the characters. I knew Chicken Man. I knew the police commissioner. I knew the mayor, who was another bumbling character. He always – When Chicken Man decided he was going to go out on assignment, he would say, "And so, Commissioner, I shall seek the enemies of our society, wherever they may lurk, in the streets and alleys of our fair city." That was Midland City. And then I would go, and I would rush to the window, which I thought was open, and it wasn't, and I would crash my way out. And unfortunately, that was the precise moment when the mayor of Midland City was coming into the building. So I was always landing on him.
On top of him.
On top of him. And then we'd hear the sirens in the distance. We knew what happened. But I'd write that, and only one. On some occasions, if I knew a vacation was coming up, I might write two a day for a week. And then we would go in the studio after Jim Runyon was off his shift, and he had lunch. At around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd go in the studio and record with Mike King doing the
before we get on to that, because I do want to hear about that, you had mentioned the last 65 episodes. So who helped you with the writing on that? Did you continue to do those by yourself?
My son Harris, by this time, had come to understand not only writing technique, and he was a fairly young man. Maybe he was 16, 17. I'm terrible at this kind of thing. But I think he was 16 or 17 years old, and he really did understand the writing technique, both for commercials and for the episodic heroes. So he came along, and I said, well, Harris, he asked if he could try it. I said, yeah, go ahead. So he did, and he was amazing. He actually was capable of writing a whole episode because he knew all the characters. And then I had a very good friend who found my first chicken suit, which was a costume from the Folies Bergère of a rooster. And that was B. Ziggy Stone, who owned a company called Finders. Finders was a little operation that advertising agencies or whomever would come to and say, can you find me a Viking ship for a photo shoot? And Finders would go find these things. And B. Ziggy, he was also a writer at Leo Burnett Agency and was very talented as in writing comedy and that kind of thing. So Harris Orkin and B. Ziggy Stone were responsible for the last 65 episodes because I was on the floor.
I can imagine. You know, one of the things, though, I knowing what I know about Harris, why I think Harris was so good at that, is one of Harris's heroes was the whole James Bond arena.
That's correct.
And I think he drew upon that fascination with that kind of hero and action person.
I think
and kind of harnessed that and went just the opposite direction for poor Chicken Man, who wanted to be James Bond.
You know, Chris, I never thought of that, but that is true. It was Harris taking the James Bond character and just going the opposite direction with him.
And saying, now you talked a little bit about Mike King, who was the very first recording engineer for Chicken Man, but could you elaborate a little bit on his contribution and how that came to be?
Well, he was I met him in Cleveland when I was working for KYW Radio. He had just come from working as a music recording engineer, and he did a lot of editing. And then in those days, pre-digital days, it was tape cuts. You just took acetate tape with a razor blade and you made cuts. And he was probably one of the most outstanding editors of music for a music company. And he came over to work as the chief engineer, recording engineer, at KYW. And then he accompanied us to, I think it was a little later than my journey there, to Chicago. I got there, and I had someone there who could help me, but they didn't have the talent. These were engineers from really the old school. And even the notion of editing tape by cutting was very strange to them. They did it all electronically. That is, they dubbed them one piece of – and it was usually for newscasts they did that. So that was all done with electronic editing as opposed to tape cutting. But Mike knew how to cut tape. And that talent was so extraordinary that when it came time to do Chicken Man, he was the perfect candidate. He was also a man who laughed at silliness. And if he hadn't been in that control room laughing, remember, when I came in, he never saw this. He saw the script, but it was the first time. He didn't read it. He would just open the mics and just listen to us. And so he was an audience for all of us, Jim Runyon and Jane Roberts then, before she married Jim. And he was our audience because if he laughed or—
He was the barometer.
He was the barometer. Mm-hmm. We knew we were on the right track. Mm-hmm. I think when I wrote, I had Mike in mind as an audience because I couldn't picture my audience for Chicken Man very well. But I could picture Mike responding to the silliness.
Yeah.
So I don't think he knows this to this day. But I really wrote for him or for his response to Chicken Man.
Mm-hmm.
And so and then he was just one heck of an editor with sound effects. He could always find the right sound effect, most of which he either invented, created on the spot with whatever tools were available, or went to two audio CDs. You don't know. We didn't know what a CD was then. Two audio LPs, which had an awful lot of sound effects on it. And with the combination of the LPs and his inventing the sounds, he was just a genius when it came to putting together the whole. And he mixed quickly. He was a
He'd have to.
Yeah. Yes.
You know. So was WCFL cooperative in the whole production and the later the distribution?
Ken Draper was. He really had to do some fast talking to allow the syndication to take place, because I don't think WCFL Radio was that thrilled about doing that, although they benefited from the syndication because the money went to them, and then I got a few more bucks in my paycheck. And that was true of Jim and Jane as well. And then before I left CFL, and it was a decision I made because of a change of management and programming policy, I decided to get out of there. They didn't want me to continue with Chicken Man. And I made an offer to buy the whole Chicken Man series. And thanks to Tom Haviland, the general manager, who paved the way for me, I got it for a very reasonable price. I think I bought it over a year's time. But I bought it and then had the rights to it. So any future syndication, which continued, was the result of my ownership of the series. And then when I founded Doxy, Dick Gorgon Creative Services, Inc., then it became part of Doxy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your partners in crime, Jim Runyon and Jane Roberts Runyon.
Yes.
Talk to me about how you all worked together and how they contributed to the characters.
Well, Jane was a very versatile and talented actress. She had done a lot of work in little theater in Chicago and was very, very capable at doing voices.
Was she already part of the WCFL staff, though?
Yes. Okay. She was Trooper. I have to correct me, Chris, because you remember if the proportions are right. She played the traffic reporter, Trooper 3624.
36. Yeah. Something you could never do today.
Yeah. 36, 24, 36. That's who she was. And then we had hired someone who was 24 or something like it, 36, 24, 36, to ride and who could actually drive a motorcycle to go around town in the skimpy outfit as the trooper. So people would see her on the streets and say, there she is. There's Trooper 36, 24, 36. Of course, it wasn't Jane.
Yes.
Although Jane had a very nice figure and was very attractive, but she wasn't capable and nor interested in motoring around the city on a bike.
Uh-huh.
So she just worked as the traffic reporter at the station. And then whenever we needed a female voice for comedy routines or contests or promos, she would participate in those. But I recruited her, and then it was designed for Jim Runyon's morning show. And Jim was also a good actor, but he mostly played the role of the announcer in the series.
Right.
I wrote the opening for the beginning of the series, Midland City. The time is morning. The office of the police commissioner of Midland City. He had this very wonderful bassy voice. And but he ad-libbed and improvised the ending of the thing.
Uh-huh.
And he would write that as Jane and I were performing, unless he played a role in the series. And I think he played two roles. One I remember, and Mike reminded me the other day when we did our interview of the other one. I forgot it right now. But he played Rodney Farver, my boyhood enemy. And he was my enemy because I stole his little red wagon. And if he wasn't playing Rodney, which he didn't play very often, that is, I didn't use the character that often, he was the announcer, and he would just sit there scribbling an ending. He already knew what he was going to say by the time we finished the thing, and Mike King would watch him and could see that he was coming up with a real good one, and he was waiting to see, as we were,
yes,
what Jim was going to say. So when we finished, and he had the script, and he knew when we were finished, very little of it was ad-lib between Jane and I. We followed the script, but
that's what I was going to ask. It didn't change pretty much from what you'd written.
No, once in a while I might add a word or a small line, or Jane might. But if we did it and it caught the other by surprise, we'd break up and then we'd have to stop and start again. But Jim's ending always killed us because it was always funny. And then we'd have to duck down away from the microphone under the table, put our heads under the table, so our laughs weren't heard over Jim's lines. But his great talent was both coming up with these very funny, spoofy, silly endings that surprised all of us, all improvised. And he was an ex-Marine and a very tough guy, by the way. And he had some other habits that unfortunately were not good for him. But in the best tradition of radio work, radio DJ and announcing work, he was the best.
Yeah,
wasn't he? He was previously in Cincinnati and worked there and was well known for both television and radio there.
I think just the way he would say "well,"
yes,
you know.
He and I don't know where that came from or why.
Well.
Well, is this the end of the Winged Warrior's career?
You know, it was almost as memorable to me as your balking.
Yeah, and I don't know where. I mean, the balking came because I had to do a chicken sound because it was a chicken, and the effect of the he's everywhere came as a result of my looking out of the window of the studio and noticing about six or seven girls from I don't know where on a tour of the station. So I went out, got them, brought them in the studio, and had them line up in front of two mics, and we got them to say in unison, "He's everywhere, he's everywhere." And that became part of the opening of the show and also the close as well. The music was well, it came from all over, and it was partly library music and came from a few other sources as well. But all of this was the result of just working with the people in the station. I don't think I ever went outside the station for talent or anyone else.
So when you were there busy writing on your pad on your train ride into Chicago, did you ever expect that the series would be a hit and go on for so long?
No, I was under... I really didn't believe that there was enough substance in what I was writing. I didn't think there was enough there. It seemed to me it would be the same gag all over and over again. And when I was challenged to continue writing after 65 episodes, I really had to expand my horizons about Chicken Man. And I began thinking not just of The Office, where most of the scenes in the first 65 episodes, except for the costume shop in the beginning, where Chicken Man decides that, or Benton Harbor decides that he will become a chicken rather than a teddy bear.
Pardon me, sir.
Yeah?
Are you by chance a vicious criminal?
Uh-huh.
Fine. Would you take a look at this costume I'm wearing?
Yeah.
Do you feel anything strange? Anything at all?
Yeah.
And what is that?
I'd like to kiss you.
Kiss me?
Yeah.
How do you account for that?
Because you look like an adorable bunny rabbit.
Well, how did it go?
What else do you have?
A teddy bear and a chicken.
A teddy bear?
It'd be cute.
Wrap up the chicken, please.
So that, and by the way, the name Benton Harbor came from Jim and I walking into a huge map of the Great Lakes area in the newsroom and looking around for the name of a city that we could use for the name of our hero, that is his alias name, his real name. That's not his alias name, but whatever it is.
Yes.
And we just glanced around the map, and it came to both of us at the same time, Benton Harbor, Michigan. And when we saw it, we knew that was it, and that's how Benton became Benton Harbor. We also used that map again on a few other occasions when we needed some heroes or some names, but basically it... What was your question?
No, you answered it. But, you know, I think for me, one of the things that also I was always so impressed with was how this character was embraced so much by the men serving in Vietnam and the nurses who were over in Vietnam. I mean, I know since I've been working with you, we get letters from vets talking about that. And also, you may remember there was actually a helicopter brigade, is that what they would be called, who had adopted Chicken Man
as
their mascot. And that used to be when they were leaving a scene or coming in. That was how they radioed back that all was okay.
Yes. The name Chicken Man was used as a military signal, too, in many cases. He was also on tanks and on planes. The name was on tanks and on planes. Or a picture of him was somebody's own version of him
right.
was. But, you know, it was written, Chris, during a very extraordinary time in American social history. The 60s, some will remember, was a social protest time.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
it was a very anti-establishment period in American history. And Chicken Man also occurred during part of the Democrat, that is the writing of it and the production of it, occurred during some conventions, I think the Democratic Convention.
68 in Chicago. Yeah.
And so there was a lot of, I think, in the character and in the situations that I drew upon or came up with, there was a lot of the anti-establishment in there. I mean, I think the police commissioner was an anti-establishment character, and I think Chicken Man as a crime fighter was an anti-establishment character.
Yes.
And in a, I guess in a sense, Miss Helfinger was as well. But she certainly was an establishment. But there wasn't any question that I was very influenced by what was going on in the city of Chicago and in the country, for that matter, with the kind of anti-establishment protest that was everywhere. There was a political streak that ran through that that today is I wouldn't be apparent to anyone who doesn't recall that period. But as I listened to it years later, I noticed that it was there.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to get back on the psychiatric couch. You've said that someday, and maybe sooner than later, you're going to show an analogy between the Chicken Man character, the story, and your own kind of psychic life, childhood through adulthood. So what the heck does all that mean?
Well, it was maybe 10 years ago that I wasn't ill. I wasn't sick. I wasn't mentally ill, or maybe I was. I was highly neurotic, that was for sure. But there was a period in my life where I thought I wanted to go into either Jungian therapy or Jungian. I wanted to become a therapist. I wanted to get into psychology and psychiatry. But it didn't happen. In fact, if I had gone to medical school at Franklin and Marshall, if I had prepared for medicine at Franklin and Marshall College, it was my intention to go to medical school and then go into psychiatry. But it didn't happen, and years later, I decided that I wanted to prepare some way to do therapy work, either with my career in radio or as a separate career if radio should fail me. And so I spent an awful lot of time in Jungian therapy. I was, as they call it in Jungian therapy, an analysand. And it was in there, in talking about my own history and my insecurities as a young person, and it goes way back, and it's not just when I was 11 or 12, but even at age 5 and 6 when I was in school. As I went back to that, recalled that period, I recognized that Chicken Man's character, his problem with lack of confidence and his always turning to the masked mother, who was sometimes called the maternal marauder, he's always turning to his mother to get him out of trouble. And of course, she was Brooke no nonsense for him. And so much as I had in my relationship with my mother, I recognized that it was almost my whole family relationship that was carried into the series unconsciously. I didn't know this at the time. But as I later listened to the episodes, deliberately listened to some episodes to see how much of my own psychic character and my earlier problems in life were in the series, I recognized how very closely I had followed my own career or my own problems in my career. So there's much more there than I think I could handle on my own. I would need some help. But I think without question will I better do it sooner rather than later. I'll take some of the Chicken Man episodes, if I'm, certainly not all of them, and try to do an analogy between my own therapy and how it related to the Chicken Man episodes.
So there's kind of a doctoral thesis lurking in there.
Yeah. If I was interested in doing that, there's no question that would be a wonderful place to start.
But I think that's also why it resonated so much for people, because
yes.
They were going through much of the same thing, the same kind of identity crisis. And I think that probably would be my answer to why the humor still holds up after all these years. Would you agree with me?
Yes. And I think that's without question. There were people who identified, particularly think of the servicemen, who are in a very vulnerable and homesick situation, scared as all hell, wherever they might be.
At the mercy of experts who may not be so expert.
Yes. And I think it was that, that their capability of seeing in Chicken Man some of their own vulnerabilities and insecurities, as well as just everyone, all people, if they were to tell the truth about their own life, if they could self-disclose, would say, yeah, I've had many moments in my life where I wasn't very confident, lacked, you know, self-esteem. And they saw that, maybe consciously or unconsciously, probably the latter, in the Chicken Man episodes. And there was always someone in their life like Miss Helfinger.
Right.
And there was always someone in their life like the police commissioner. Maybe it was a boss or teacher. But I think there wasn't any question that you're right. They were able to relate personally to the Chicken Man story as a result of that.
And I think those issues still hold up today. We still have those kind of relationship issues, which is why the humor still works. Well, I thank you, Dick, for taking the time to talk with me today. I think it was really amazing and interesting to get a look at the behind-the-scenes Chicken Man.
Well, I really appreciate your saying that, Chris. And I'm glad now I asked you to interview me because it really worked out swell.
Because you were going to try to interview yourself, weren't you?
Yeah,
that would have been good.
That would have been really, really silly.
Can you give us a bawk, bawk, bawk just for goodbye for old time's sake?
Yeah, I'll try to land at the same time. That gets a little harder to do. But I have
Oh, dear. He's moving furniture now. I should point that out.
I have to take the stand and flatten it out in order to drop down here. So, I see, as I grow older, my capacity to do a falsetto has left me. So I'm going to do the best I can.
Okay.
It's better if you hear the actual one, and maybe Adam will be able to let us hear that after we do this. So here's as I always ever called. Now, of course, Chicken Man could not fly.
No.
As everyone who remembers the famous bridge scene, where he was chased off the bridge. He was chased off a bus because a little girl on the bus said, "Tell the chicken to fly, Mommy." And so the woman said, "Fly." And everyone on the bus chased me off the bus, and I ran up to the top of a bridge and was stuck there until my maternal marauder came along and rescued me. But I would then attempt to fly, and I got to take a pen out of my pocket, my glasses before I smash them. I would just beat my chest and go, "Rock, buck, 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 buck." I have arrived, the wonderful white-winged warrior Chicken Man, to fight crime and or evil wherever it exists, along the byways and highways of our nation, not to mention the alleys, too. How do you do?
That's it. Thanks, Dick.
Thank you, Chris.
This interview was recorded and mixed by Radio Ranch Chief Engineer Adam Peterson.